offering a most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, we welcome you to this week's episode of Afternoon Satsang. As always, this is Prem from Team Radio Sai, and with me is Brother Arvind. This is the week we promised to take on a general topic of interest for all of us, and we've taken up a topic which definitely couldn't be categorized as interesting, but nevertheless something which is of use to all of us, because it is based on something which we all face quite often in life. Before we go into what the topic is about, and before we share thoughts on what Swami has spoken about this, because primarily we're going to draw from what Swami has said, the way Swami has himself reacted to this particular situation we're going to talk about, we most humbly offer our loving pranams at Swami's lotus feet, and we draw the strength and inspiration from him. And I invite Brother Arvind to join all of us. Sairam Arvind.
Sairam Prem, this topic about how you respond when your guru, when your god, when your master is being criticized, this is, as you said, of general interest to so many people, because this is something that we face in day-to-day lives. And many times when I have got this opportunity of interacting with youth and elders alike, there have been people who have asked this question: how do we respond to people who criticize Swami? And, you know, especially with the outburst of social media and other avenues where an individual's thought and opinion can just be spread in a rapid manner across the globe, it becomes even more important. Because, like, you know, recently there was this magnificent concert, the symphony, the right. orchestra, the same orchestra that played for Bhagwan's birthday in Prashanthi Nilayam, it played in Germany in a special orchestra hall, and it was a very, very, very well received event, and everybody was thrilled. There was an exhibition on Bhagwan's life. In fact, Vinod and Sai Prakash, our colleagues at Radio Sai, who were there in Germany to cover this whole event, they were saying that the Germans, you know, generally they are a very disciplined and a kind of a silent lot, and even their appreciation comes in a very disciplined manner. But the whole German audience, they got up and gave a standing ovation. That was the thumping success of the program, and everybody was so thrilled, filled with divine feelings, and they also saw through the entire exhibition about Swami. And most of the people, what they expressed was, oh my God, Satya Sai Baba is such a magnificent and wonderful being. Why is it that there is so much negativity? What do they mean by so much negativity? It basically boils down to one or two videos. One happening to be that BBC so-called documentary on Secret Swami, which they did to gather eyeballs possibly. And that has spread. It has got so many views, and it so happens that people land on that first. Because if you see the sheer number of videos, the number of positive videos on Swami far outnumber the negative ones. But yet, the spread that is possible through one or two videos is enough to poison so many minds, poison so many hearts. But that is what I was coming to, that it becomes more relevant today, because it is possible that one little video, which would have otherwise been seen by just 100 or 200 people, can gather a million views and really create problems, doubts to so many, directly and indirectly. Especially when people see and come and stand up front, or, you know, they come and oppose you, speak against the things that is very close to your heart. We often find ourselves in a position where we are not able to answer or don't know how to react. We have anger, we have sadness, there's a cauldron of feelings within us. So I think with that in mind, this theme will be very, very useful. And I don't know about the listeners, I was definitely very, very thrilled and eager to go to this topic, because this is something that we also face in our day-to-day life.
One thing which Swami would often refer to, and apart from your idea of defending Swami, defending your faith, defending your beliefs, that is one thing. But generally what Swami would often tell us is, Swami would not like us to go into any kind of argumentation. You know, on many, many occasions, you know, Swami has shown this to students where there would have been an argument somewhere, and Swami would reflect it in Mandir, saying that he is not happy about that sort of an argument, right? Many ways, sometimes very hilariously, sometimes saying that I was watching it, I think one which I can recall is there was once an argument between two commerce students about what is the value of the dollar or something like that, right? And it started off like that, but it eventually got into a very heated argument that involved a lot of other topics. And at the end of it, one of them, I think, apparently even said, hey, we've got into an argument and Swami doesn't like arguments. Right? And then they left it at that immediately, and they stopped the argumentation. And apparently when they came back that evening for darshan to the mandir, Swami came up to them and Swami did not apprehend them, Swami did not scold anything. And Swami said, I think the dollar is 32 rupees or something like that.
Okay.
Very cryptically Swami said something and walked away just to show that, yeah, I did know that you had an argument. Probably saying that I'm happy that you acknowledged it yourself that it is not right to be in an argument and you stopped. So one thing is the argumentation itself is something which Swami does not really like and does not Swami approve of. But added to that, this idea of criticism of Swami, because that is something where probably hitting us where we are very soft, right? That's probably where it's going to hurt us most. So it involves a lot of other things. How do you manage your emotions? One thing. And what is the right thing to do? Because most often that's the question we are faced with. What is the right thing to do there rather than what you want to do, right?
You know, what you spoke just now, it triggered a thought in me and reminded me of two different incidents from my own life, you know. The thought that came was when you said, this is our soft point. Immediately, what my heart was saying is, oh, there itself, therein lies the answer, because is Swami your weak point or is Swami your strong point? So if we consider Swami as our strong point, then it definitely means, I don't know how, but it definitely means that I should not get affected because Swami is my strong point. That is the thought that arose. And you know, when you were saying about this argumentation, there was this time in my life where I felt that I'm talking too much. I now also am convinced that I talk too much, but I'm very happy because most of the things that I talk is about Swami, and I have received encouragement from Swami to talk too much. And what I'm going to narrate is one such episode where, you know, when I was feeling that I'm talking too much, I should start reduce my talk. Mm-hmm. I wrote this in a letter and I wanted to give it to Swami and was not able to give it to Swami. When I slept in the night, I had a dream. In the dream, I was able to give this letter to Swami, and Swami reading this letter tells me, so you know what you should do. So I said, yes, Swami, I should talk less. To my surprise in my dream, Swami said, no, don't reduce talking. So I was like very happy saying that, Swami, this is what I thought was my weakness. But if you say that I can go on with it, I'm very happy. The next statement Swami said is, don't reduce talking, reduce arguing. So, you know, when you said that Swami is very much not for arguing, I understand it so well because Swami made it clear there is no problem in talking as long as it doesn't get argumentative. Don't get into arguments. And on that note, I'm reminded of the second incident, what I was referring to, which was precisely possibly the way that we shouldn't be dealing with this.
Mm-hmm.
It happened on a very beautiful day, the day when Brother Bishu and myself, we left for Odisha,
okay,
the state of Indian state of Orissa, to document Swami's housing project there. And that evening, you know, Bhagwan had called us into Yajur Mandir and blessed us personally. So we both were on a kind of a high. We were in cloud nine. We were so happy. We almost floated to the railway station, got into the train. And as the train started, we noticed that in our compartment were a lot of people who had boarded at Prashanthi Nilayam. Possibly this was a compartment that the Indian Railways in its berth and quota system allots, you know. So this was a compartment allotted to Prashanthi Nilayam. So a lot of people from Prashanthi Nilayam. There was one gentleman who, you know, began to talk condescendingly about Swami, saying, talking about all those who come to Prashanthi Nilayam as fools and saying that I have passed by this station hundreds of times. I see people rushing out and rushing in. I don't understand. I have never felt the need to go there because I feel all this is rubbish. And, you know, he went on and on and on in his criticism. It irritated me a bit, but as I said, both Bishu and myself, we were in some other level itself, because we have just had this beautiful interaction with Swami. And I was able to appreciate what Swami says, that when, you know, an iron piece is brought close to a magnet, the iron piece also gets magnetized. So possibly because of the touch with Swami, we were also those selfless, loving beings and just didn't bother about what he was saying. But he went on.
Just probably a few deals, you must have narrated this before. I think Swami called you into Swami's residence and spoke to you. I think gave some snacks for the travel.
For the train travel, gave sweets.
Quite understandable why you were in a hurry, right?
Also gave some snacks. He said not only sweet snacks, then gave us some money. He told you go there and shop. We were very touched, you know. This is what our parents do when we leave and when we are children. Not when you become, you know, possibly an adult. But here was Swami, we are always children for him. And it was so beautiful. So that's why we were in that state. And this happened. The next day morning, as we woke up and as I was returning after brushing my teeth, you know, in the train, this person was there putting paste to his brush and he had restarted it, you know, Once again, Bishu's response was the same. He just went, took his seat and he was lost in the bliss. But I think by now I had returned back to ground. See, that's the thing. When Swami gives us something, an experience, it is so beautiful. It's totally left to us how long we sustain it. See, in this case, Bishu had sustained it even the next day. Mine was gone. Mine was gone by the end of the previous day. There are some people who are able to sustain it for a week, some for months, some for years. That is why we meet some people who have had one interaction with Swami and they are like, they are talking to Swami just now and they have come out. So it depends not only on how much Swami gives us, but how well we sustain it. So coming back to the story, at this point in time, I got a little irritated. So I was trying to, you know, talk with him. Though inside I knew that it's going to lead to an argument, I couldn't resist it. So I went, and in the course of the conversation, he was asking me what I had done. I told him about MBA and all this. And instead of directly mocking me, he started speaking about his daughter who has done an MBA, who is earning lots of dollars in America, and what a kind of awesome life she has. And he went on and on about her and how much she's earning, what respect she has. And he was trying to say that if an MBA degree is done, it should at least result in this. I mean, what is the salary that you get? I didn't want to tell him the salary. I just said, no, whatever I need, I have. So he was saying these are all arguments of a person who doesn't know. If you don't want to tell your salary, obviously I am sure it doesn't compare with my daughter's. And he went on and on like this. Now what I did was, as he was speaking, I was trying to gather his vulnerable points. And when he was speaking, I just felt that he's very attached to his daughter, his only child, and his daughter has actually left him and gone to the US, settled there, and doesn't look like she's coming back. Once I gathered this much, after listening to him for 15 minutes, I began my part of the conversation where I told him that, you know, my parents are very happy that I have done my MBA. I am with them. I am there every morning to wish them good morning. I am there to take care of them. If they get sick, if they get whatever, I am there for them. This is what they wanted from me. And I am so happy I am able to do this. I even went to the extent of saying, even if you die, you know, it will take your daughter one day to come and see your dead body also. If this is what you wanted from her, you are happy, no, then be happy. My parents were not happy like this. They wanted somebody to... And you know, I went on, and I could see that I was making a dent on him. Because this was his very soft point. He broke down actually almost. And he just got up and walked away to brush his teeth. And I'm not exaggerating, we had to get down at Vishakhapatnam. Till Vishakhapatnam came, this guy didn't return back. I felt very, very triumphant, you know. I felt very triumphant and I said, serves you right. Because I felt that all others in the compartment also, they were somewhat happy that guy got it back for all the hurt he had caused. So that was the incident. But I must confess that today when I look back at it, I'm not proud of it. Because, you know, I don't think that Swami would have appreciated that response wherein you hurt me, I'm going to hurt you back in a manner that you understand what it means. Because as Mahatma Gandhi says, an eye for an eye or a tooth for a tooth will make the whole world toothless and blind. It doesn't help. It doesn't help because we are hurting ourselves when we are able to look from Swami's vision that all are one. Whether I hurt him or he hurts me, it is the same thing. So I really don't think that this is the way we should do it. There's also a problem in this method because even if I think that, okay, I'll hurt him into silence so that he doesn't hurt me, it depends on capacities. You know, I may have beaten him in an argument. I might have found some vulnerability. What if the other person had been a shrewder opponent and he had found my vulnerability and he had smashed me? Or he had out-argued me and silenced me? There is no guarantee that I'll always be better. It depends on my skill and capabilities. And there is no way to know what is my skill level or my capability level. Therefore, though this is a method and this is possibly the reason we are telling it right in the beginning, because this is a wrong method. It is wrong even from a theoretical point of view, because Because there is no guarantee of you having peace having done that. For instance, though I won that there, today also when I look back at it, I feel, no, possibly this is not the right way to do. So I'm not at peace at the way I did it. So I think definitely the objective in our satsang will not be to find ways how we can offend back or shut them up, but definitely what we can do to ensure that we are protected. So I think more than offense, we will discuss defense strategies.
Before we get to that, you know, it's important to understand why Swami says argumentation is wrong. And what is the difference between argumentation and a discussion and or a debate, right? That is an important thing to understand, because if you look at it, debate is a integral part of Indian culture itself. We all know the classic debate between Adi Shankara and Mandana Mishra, which Swami would speak of so highly. 18 days it lasts. It has been presided by the wife of Mandana Mishra, showing that how equal and equitable a lady she was, that she was able to...
Ubhaya Bharati,
who was able to, you know, sit there in judgment of her own husband and eventually declare him as the loser. You know, if Swami would speak about her righteousness. But Swami would always speak about this, and in fact, the entire career of Adi Shankara was one debate after the other, where he goes and keeps discussing with scholars and wins them over to the idea of Advaita. You know, that is how he spreads the study of the Upanishads. That's how the story goes. So in what way we say that some arguments are wrong or some debates are wrong and some debates are acceptable? Going back to that, the Indian scriptures speak about four types of argumentations or discussions, right?
Hmm.
We know that the word which we usually use for a debate is vada, right?
Yes.
Actually, there are four types of vadas. One, vada is actually one of the categories. It's not the only category.
Oh, I was not aware of that. Okay. Right.
So one thing Swami says, the starting thing, which actually does not figure in the discussion we're having today, is called samavada, right? Or samvada, I don't know how it's pronounced. That can happen only between a teacher and a disciple, right? Where a disciple can ask questions not to check the greatness of the teacher, but to enhance his own learning.
Interesting, because when you said samvada, my first thought was, you mean this is also a kind of argument? Because samvada is a term given for different conferences.
Okay.
You know, when we call it a samvada of different people, for a conference. So I was wondering, how on earth did samvada become a way of argumentation? But when you say that, right, it is in order to gain knowledge, yes, so therefore a conference...
Exactly. So in a conversation between a disciple and a master, the disciple is entitled to ask questions. But as we have always, you know, referred to that incident from Shirdi Baba's life, it is got to be pariprashna and not merely prashna. Hmm. Where you ask to enhance your knowledge, not to check whether the teacher is knowledgeable enough. So that is one thing, samvada. Of course, it doesn't come under argument per se, so we'll keep that aside. The other is vada, which was what scholars like Adi Shankara involved in, where two parties come together with their own schools of thought, and they say that these are my arguments, because of which I believe in this, and the other person says these are my arguments, and they come with a completely open mind to say that if you're able to convince me, I will accept your way of thinking. And that is how, you know, Mandana Mishra actually becomes Advaitin by practice after losing this battle with him. And Ubhaya Bharati also joins him because she is the better half. Hmm. So Swami would say that this is one way of argument, where vada, which is the right way of argument, where you come into a discussion with an open mind and you put on table what you believe in, not questioning the other person's belief. Right? You say that this is why I believe in these things. And then you refer you compare your notes and you say, okay, I agree with what you say. And the process leads to an enhanced knowledge of both parties, actually.
This is ideally how all our debate competition should be held, right?
Right, exactly. This is how any debate is supposed to be held, be it even in the parliament. Right? That's far from how it is. And then the second category, or the next lower category, is what is referred to as jalpa, right? Where jalpa is the two parties coming together with the idea of winning the debate. They say that I will, you know, stamp my authority by saying that this is how it has to be done. Right?
Possibly a modern day example would be the courtroom.
Right, courtroom, and courtroom is pretty much falling little bit on jalpa, on a little bit on the next one. I'll explain how that happens. But more like, you know, our debates which we just have for fun. Many times we just get into the argument for the sake of the argument, just to win the argument, right? It is not the ideal way, but it probably is not a very harmful way if you are not attacking the other person. If you're still only asserting your views, but you're not open for the other person's views, right? You're only going to be pushing your idea. You're not going to even listen to the other person so clearly, right? Swami says that even this is actually fine, because this way, you know, the different schools of thoughts get strengthened. It's fine. You know, you to believe in yours to an extent blindly is also okay. That's what Swami says. And the third one, which is the worst, is called Vidanda, right? It's, I think, I don't know in Kannada if they use that, but in many southern languages they say Vidanda Vadam means to get into an argument
for the heck of it,
and you know, it only causes disharmony. And that is a case where, you know, you want to win the thing by hook or crook. So you hit at the other person's vulnerabilities, you hit at where the other person does not understand his own views. You know, many times it happens. You might see that what he is saying is actually valid, but you see that he is not very confident of it, so you
attack
it,
right? Yes.
So even though you know that what you're doing is wrong, you attack that person. And they say sometimes what you refer to as courtroom arguments comes under partially in Vidanda, because a lawyer does not always endorse the views that he's arguing for. He's just as an arguer. So many times you're arguing for views which you're not convinced yourself. So Swami says that is the worst form of argumentation. And, you know, interestingly, in the Bhagavad Gita, you know that Krishna says, among Vedas, I'm the Samaveda, among this, I'm those series of things which he says. In that, Krishna says, among arguments, I am Vada, he says.
Okay.
And I think recently in a discourse which we played, Swami was very clearly telling that your goal should be to forsake the Jalpa and Vidanda and as much as possible do indulge in the, you know, the most special form of argument or most right form of argument. Jalpa is okay, but please Vidanda, don't do that at all. So I think that clearly gives us an idea of how to deal with criticism also.
It also, you know, gives a very nice perspective that you need not actually take it lying down. Because it is not as if that you should not speak at all. Because when Swami says Vada is good, so it means that there is something that has to be done also. It's not that you just keep receiving all the dirt and accept it. So that much becomes very clear. Possibly, you know, when we look at so many instances, whether we take Karanjia, we had, I think, covered him in our satsang on I came, I saw and I got conquered. They came, they saw, they got conquered. How he had come to write about Swami and you know, smash Swami because he was a charlatan, he was somebody who is looting people and he didn't believe all this. Karanjia comes and Rusi Karanjia, he's a person who has interviewed all the greats in the world, and he comes and at the end of his stay in Prashanti, he comes out with a article titled God Lives in India. And the way Swami did was only out of love. When we look at the whole episode, it looks as if Swami started with Vada, and towards the end, it became a Samvada. Because Rusi Karanjia was down and he was humbly asking questions and seeking answers like a spiritual seeker. So, I think that's a nice direction for us. Let's try to make all our arguments into Vada, which finally leads to Samvada. Because if we feel that we have some knowledge which is superior compared to what you have, then definitely there should be a flow of that knowledge which happens only in Samvada. So, we can't afford to go into anything that is worse than the Vada level. And, you know, in this context, I'm reminded of an incident that happened with Professor Nanjundaya, who was formerly the controller of examinations. You know, because as we opened our debate, not debate, our satsang, saying that it is not about offense, but about strengthening our defense. So, he had, Professor Nanjundaya had read some things in the newspaper which had hurt him a lot. And he got his opportunity to travel with Bhagwan in the car. And among the different things they discussed, he brought this up. You know, he mustered courage and he said, Swami, I have a prayer. Can I just make it? And Swami says, yes, tell me what it is. And he says, Swami, I have read such horrible things against you. It's very, very painful to read such things, Swami. So, please, Swami, see that people do not write such criticism against you. So, quite a decent prayer to make, right? I mean, Swami, please ensure that people don't do this. Swami told him that you should not pray like this. He said, just as you have the right to love me, they have an equal right to criticize me. Just as I respect your love and bless you, I respect their feelings and bless them. So you should not pray like this. mean, this is startling, you know. Swami saying like this, it's so amazing. And I must, you know, I must say that I'm, when I read this part, I was simply overwhelmed. But you know, Anjundaya sir did not give up, so he wanted some kind of a resolution. So he said, Swami, then please, I pray that these terrible words or such words which hurt me, because I feel that they are against you, let them not reach my attention, let them not reach my ears. And Swami immediately, you know, he smiled and he said, ah, that you can pray. You know, that you can pray. So you see, as devotees, it becomes very clear that we have no right to criticize those who are criticizing. Because then what is the difference between them and us? If I also retort in the same manner. And as Swami said, they have equal right to think of him as they want. It's their freedom of expression, of love, freedom of speech, possibly, towards Swami. So, but at the same time, Swami encourages us to build our own defenses. Because as he told Nanjundaya sir, you can pray that it doesn't reach your ears. Yeah. That is your defense. And that is one of the reasons, dear listeners, that we have decided that a large part of our satsang, we will focus on these measures in which we build our defenses. And, before I hand it to you, Prem, I must thank Brother Karan Diwan for sharing this beautiful incident. You know, just before the satsang, just shared the theme of the satsang and asked everybody on Facebook whether, you know, they can contribute whatever. So that I felt that usually when they write to listener@radiosai.org, we get the feedback after the satsang gets over. And many times if our theme the next week is not the same, we are unable to incorporate that feedback. So possibly we can do this. And I am very grateful to him for sharing this beautiful episode, which gives us a very nice insight.
Exactly. And, you know, Professor Nanjundaya asked was very, very important, because there he was asking about, you know, definitely, he was being pained by what he was hearing, just like most of us. And he was saying, Swami, I am being pained. I don't want to be pained. It's not like I am being pained. I want to return that to the person who is giving me pain. You know, the first and foremost thing is, is that clear in our mind? You know, when we try to get into an argument with somebody who starts criticizing Swami, the first thing is, are we having this idea that, you know, you hurt me, now you will not leave this place without being hurt yourself? I think if that is the primary motive with which we step in, or even if that motive creeps in through the argument, I think we might as well stop defending Swami, because in the process you will be offending Swami more than you will be defending Swami.
I think we'll be defending our ego at that point.
And absolutely. And, you know, the clearest indication of that is at the end of it, you will not feel pleasant about it at all.
You will not be peaceful. Yes. We think we are doing this because we want to get peaceful. Somebody tells again, Swami, we are upset, our peace is upset, and by fighting back, I'll regain peace. But if I don't gain the peace in the end, what is the use? In fact, Sister Purnima Srinath from South Africa, she was sharing that they are, you know, away from India, so when they got to know of Bhagwan's physical departure on the 24th of April, they were of course shattered, both she, her husband, their family. And that was a time when, you know, a lot of media coverage was done on Bhagwan, and most of it in the negative way. So she said that some of her own friends, people whom she had to interact on a day-to-day basis, they began to speak very badly in her presence. And she said that she decided to just stay away from them for a good many number of years. But you know, even staying away from them did not help her. She says that because I had to do the basic number of interactions that I had to do with them, I had to carry out with them, I had to do that. So it was not helping at all, till she said that I decided that I would forgive them. I would forgive them because they are ignorant, they don't know, they speak like this. And if I am not so ignorant, I can't afford to retaliate in this manner. And she said the moment she forgave them, the pain vanished and the peace came. And she says that today, the same people know about their involvement in the organization, what it stands for, and they also respect her feelings and thoughts about it. But all this happened only after she was able to genuinely forgive them. So, you know, it is so beautiful and powerful, because the locus of control is within us. And as long as you are in it to hurt the other person, you also don't get peace. As long as we keep the focus that, you know, the entire reason for this whole exercise is so that I gain my peace, I think we'll automatically be taking those steps. And in these two things, you know, two things that came out from her experience, I feel there are two keys towards handling criticism on Swami. One is, you know, keeping away from such people. Second thing is about, you know, having forbearance, kshama, and being ready to forgive them. I think these are two key learnings we can take from this episode and possibly discuss further in detail.
Exactly. I think the starting point for anything else, you know, any of these things, if you can get away from the scene, if you can avoid that person completely, I think as long as that option is available, probably we must take that option. Because if we are not ready for it, you know, many times we want to defend Swami, but we are not ready for that. We don't have the mental maturity to do that. But probably silence is a good way. And when we feel more stronger, we can get back to it. But the other point which he made about forgiveness, you know, the moment you go into forgiveness, it's like a whole maze by itself. There are layers and layers of it. But one thing which I'd probably bring up here and, you know, correlated to what we started off with as different types of arguments. Many times we get upset with a person not because of what that person really is, but what we think that person is. You know, we misunderstand the words, we misunderstand where that person's argument is coming from. And many times that is the cause of our anger against that person. So when someone comes and criticizes us, if possible, can we give that person the benefit of doubt? Saying that, you know, he does not know. I mean, I have had the blessing of knowing Swami personally. He or she does not have that blessing. And probably I'll give it to him, you know, I'll give it to her that you are at a disadvantage, so let me, you know, not take your word too seriously. So I think that forgiveness comes from that you kind of understand that not everybody is as fortunate as you are. And when you do that, probably, you know, even something which starts off as a vidandavadam, or, you know, someone is coming to attack you, you might say, probably you don't know enough, and I will put up with your tantrums for a bit, and then you will be in a state where you will be able to receive what I am here to give.
I think that is more akin to how a mother or a father put up with the tantrums of a child. Because though they feel that what the child is doing is wrong, though they feel that the child has to be corrected, somewhere within they know that the child's knowledge or ability is only so much, so I need to be more patient, I need to, you know, have more kshama. I think that is the kind of situation that you are speaking about, because though the person opposite might be an adult, when it comes to this particular theme of understanding Swami, in that, they might be children. So I think the kind of feeling that a mother has towards the child, the patience, the forbearance, and the ability to simply keep silent and swallow without retaliating, I think that is what is the point that you were trying to make.
Right. And the other thing is, probably it's important to understand where that person's argument actually comes from. And I can tell this because I've been on both sides. Right? I've been on the side which questions Swami, and I'm on this side which defends Swami too. You know, many times when you question someone's faith, when you look at a Sai devotee and say, oh, you're going behind that Sai Baba, it is not because I understand who Swami is or I know that Swami is wrong. Many times it's to defend my non-belief. Just like how when I speak on behalf of Swami, I'm defending my belief. A non-devotee is actually trying to defend his non-belief. Because when he's saying that, if he says that, oh, it's a very good thing you're going to Sai Baba, the next thing is, why are you not going there?
Yeah, you're a fool, you're missing out.
Exactly. You're trying to defend yourself from that tag of a fool. Invariably, that's the ego with which a person who defends Swami comes. And sadly to say, when we defend our belief also, it's the same ego which is actually in the forefront. We think that you're on the side of Swami, so you're holier, but actually it's the same ego which is, you know, playing out on both sides.
Absolutely. I think, dear listeners, at this point we'll take a little break. And after the break, we will go into more details of two strategies that we have arrived at. One is about avoiding bad company, and the other is about silence, forbearance, possibly. So both those we'll go after the break. Don't go away anywhere. After this break, we'll be coming back to it soon.
in the garden of every heart. Sow the seeds of love. Let it rain like tears from heaven. Pour down your love from above. And as the heart grows, it opens like the petals of a rose. Can you smell the sweet perfume? Like the jasmine flower at night, its fragrance, it touches everyone. When all the hearts unite to become part of the whole. In the garden of the soul, for love can only increase in this garden of heavenly peace, and love can only increase in the garden of heavenly peace. Let it grow, let it grow, let it grow, let it grow. As the lotus needs water, so dies my heart without you. And if all I see is an illusion, then is the sky really blue? There's an answer for mankind in the garden of the mind. And love can only increase in the garden of heavenly peace. And love can only increase in the garden of heavenly peace. Let it go, let it grow, let it grow, let it grow. Let it grow, let it grow, let it grow, let it grow, let it grow. Let it grow. In prashanti nilayam. In Prashanti Nilayam. In Prashanti Shanti.
Welcome back, dear listeners, and I think that will be what we will be doing. Om Shanti 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 Hi. That is what will be the conclusion of our satsang. So we will proceed where where we were talking about building our defense methods. And I think, Prem, you had a very interesting take on using tact.
Right, exactly. You know, once apparently Swami was in the portico talking to the students, and Saprakash would say this. He was in school when this interaction happened. And Swami was talking, and in that Swami was telling about the different types of yogas and all that. And then suddenly Swami said, there is one more yoga, which is not mentioned in the scriptures. And then Swami said, that yoga is knack yoga. And Swami would say that, see, sometimes when you're in a sticky situation, you have to use your intelligence to get out of it without harming yourself, without harming the other person. You know, you just kind of extricate yourself from that situation. Probably you are not ready for that situation to be resolved the right way. Probably the other person is not ready. But you just kind of, you know, status quo, you come out of it.
So that your piece, piece is retained. Huh?
Exactly. And one such thing which Saprakash himself would narrate is the way his father handled a situation like this using his, knack.
Hmm.
Apparently when he was traveling by train once, there was this Bengali person who was in the same cabin. And Saprakash's father was reading Sanatan Sarthi. So the moment he saw Sanatan Sarthi, and of course there must have been a picture of Swami right in the front there, and he said, hey, what is all this? You people are young, you're educated, and you go behind people like these Babas and all that. And he went off into a series of his rants. And so, you know, and Saprakash's father tried to reason out with him. He said, see, you know, I come from a very small background, and Swami has given me confidence. And he said, hey, don't give me all these things. He said, even education can give you that and all that kind of thing. Nothing was working with this person. So then he asked this man, do you believe in God? He said, of course I do believe in God. So he said, what is your idea of God? He said, for me, God means Krishna. Krishna is the Supreme Lord. And there's nothing more greater than the Bhagavad Gita. And all of these people simply come and, you know, give you jumbled up versions of the Bhagavad Gita and they get away with it. Krishna is the Supreme Lord and Bhagavad Gita is the Supreme Scripture, he said. So he said, oh, that's fine. Even I read the Bhagavad Gita and I find a lot of solace in that. Mm-hmm. And then Saprakash's father said, look, I'm a painter, right? I'm an artist. And I always enjoy portraying whatever attracts me, whatever figure attracts me, whatever person attracts me. Mm-hmm. So he said, I always have this desire to draw a picture of Krishna. So will you help me draw that? So this person said, yes, you can ask me anything, anything in the Bhagavad Gita, anything related to Krishna, I can tell you. So he said, because you are so knowledgeable about Krishna and Bhagavad Gita, probably you will be able to help me in, you know, drawing this portrait of Krishna. And then Saprakash's father asked this man, do you know the height of Krishna? This person went blank. He said, you ask anything else, how do I know, you know, how tall Krishna was? So then Saprakash's father said, see, here is the person whose the least of the least attributes is the physical attributes of that person. And even that you do not know. You don't even know how that person looked, you know, what were his features. But you're ready to accept him as a Supreme Lord. You know, you're ready to worship him and give all your allegiance to him. Then why is it so difficult for you to accept that I can fall in love with a master like this and I can have devotion to him?
Whom I have personally seen, whom I have
personally experienced. Who has personally uplifted my life. He said, why is it so difficult for you to accept? And that person had no answer to that question. And apparently after that he fell silent. And then he started asking, he wanted to know about Swami after that. Probably it's not a very great argument to give. You know, probably, you know, you might say that what is there asking about Krishna's height and all that. But it doesn't matter what if he was a Christian or a Muslim for that matter who believes
what
in
if
the
he was an atheist?
God.
What if he was an atheist,
right? A Scientologist or whatever it is. Probably that argument is not foolproof in all situations. But you know, he used his knack to get out of that, and he ensured that his peace of mind was kept. At the same time, he did not really insult that person completely, but he just made him see the point of, you know, where he was coming from.
No, absolutely. When you spoke of atheist, has reminded of another incident. Yeah, that is beautiful. Knack yoga. If you can use a knack to get out without, if you can emerge unscathed, best it is. But when we speak of our defenses, one of the first we said is to avoid bad company. And it becomes so important that we avoid bad company for multiple reasons. And when we say avoid bad company, it's not just about keeping away from people who are criticizing Swami or who have negative thoughts about Swami or our Guru. Sailesh sir, you know, he was narrating, and he has recorded in his book also this episode, wherein when he was about 10, 15 years ago maybe, he had walked into the Institute library and he came across a book wherein there's a dialogue between a theist and an atheist.
Mm-hmm.
And this book has been written by an atheist. And it's not an ordinary atheist. It's a Nobel Prize winning person.
Okay.
I won't say chemist, biologist, this is nothing. I won't even mention his name because it will beat the purpose of my narration if I mention his name then.
Mm-hmm.
When I say avoid bad company. So he started reading it because he felt that there is no way, I agree, scientifically there is no way to prove the existence of God. But he also knew, and this is a fact, this is a fact that nobody can negate. There is no way to disprove the existence of God also. That's why the debate rages on forever and ever and ever and ever. There's no way to scientifically prove God's existence. There's no way to scientifically prove that God doesn't exist. So, Silaser had many times, you know, had spoken to the so-called intellectuals and different people, his own students, because he's a master physics teacher, lecturer. So he felt very confident that, let me see what are the arguments he's putting. I can beat him with my arguments. With that confidence, he opened and started reading the book. And in no time, he got so engrossed, he began to, you know, almost, he was sucked into the book. He kept reading. At the end of it, he says, when I finished it, I was shaken, you know. My fundamentals began to shake because I had no logical foundation on which my faith in Swami was standing. Faith itself is not based on logic. It's faith. That's why it's called faith. I just believe. And he said that so many thoughts began and I was very shaken. I was feeling so nervous. I began to pray to Swami. I said, Swami, please calm the waves of this unrest in my mind. Please, Swami, you do something. And with full faith again, you know, holding on to whatever faith was left, he walked and pulled out one Satisai Speaks. And he says, he pulled out a Satisai Speaks and opened a random page. And he says, even as I read the first words, I felt so much at peace. Because the first sentence he read was, there is no use of arguing with an atheist about the existence of God. And he said, wow, okay. He continued to read. It went on. It said, it is like an argument between two people on the ground who see an aeroplane flying and argue whether there is a pilot or not. You know, the person who says that there is a pilot is as wrong as the person who says there is no pilot, because both are just saying what they feel. Says, only a person who goes to the level of the aircraft and goes in and sees can say that there is a pilot. Or the plane should land on earth and you should go in and you should see if there is a pilot. If neither of these two have happened, then both the people, one who is saying that there is a pilot and one who says that there is no pilot, both are fools. And as Silaser, you know, read this, he felt so thrilled because he felt that the first, that you going to the level of the aircraft was denoting the path of karma and jnana. Where through your actions and through your intense rigor, you go to the level of God, you know, become one with Him and understand that there's a pilot in the plane. The other is the path of bhakti, where you draw the grace of God upon you and you get convinced. So, he said that when I read this, I felt so much at peace. I just shut the other book and kept it away. And in fact, whenever he narrates this incident, I have been very curious because I want to know. So, I keep asking him, which is that book that you read about? Mm-hmm. He says, no, it defeats the purpose if I tell you the name of the book. I won't tell you the name of the book. I won't tell you the name of that person. Mm-hmm. So, I also don't know that, and that's why it is not there, and it makes sense that it is not told. So you see, when we say avoid bad company, it's not just about the people, it's also about such themes, such topics, such writing. Because many times we enter into an argument or discussion thinking that, you know, we are convinced in our faith, we are strong enough, and suddenly we realize in the middle of the war or a battle that we are tottering, and simply we realize that we invited this upon ourselves. That's why avoid bad company becomes so very important in our defense against criticism about our guru.
Right. No, there are two points which are completely distinct from each other, which strikes me.
Hmm.
One thing is, you know, as you're saying, you know, here is a person who is labeled himself as an atheist. And the moment he comes to an argument saying that I am an atheist, it eventually becomes an Vidarnavadam, as Swami said, you know, because you are coming to assert your position, you're not coming to learn something.
Mm.
And invariably it becomes only an argument between an atheist and a theist. The other thing which is striking is, you know, many times you even end up in atheism through a very, very deep study of spirituality. You oftentimes you see that, you know, somebody who gets into, you know, very deep into Vedanta, very deep into the Upanishads, would kind of tend towards an atheistic belief. And in fact, it is true.
Mm.
If you look at it, they say that there are 16 schools of learning in the Hindu, in Sanatan Dharma, right? You know, many, many forms of Dvaita, Advaita and Vishishta and Sankhya and all of that. They say of the 16, 14 to 15 are actually atheistic. They very, very strongly don't speak of a God who is kind of animated and who is taking care of the devotees. That kind of concept does not have a place in it at all. Because the thing is, the moment you go into intellectualization, meaning intellectualizing any concept, you actually gravitate towards an atheistic approach.
Hmm.
And that is why, you know, Swami would say the Vedas itself is divided into karma, upasana and then jnana. The karma kanda, upasana kanda and jnana kanda. And invariably when we start studying, we always want the cream of the cream, right? Because we think that if I associate myself with the cream, then I become an elite. So instead of going through karma, upasana and jnana, which is action, worship and then wisdom.
It's almost like, yeah, work, worship, wisdom.
Right. We go straight to the wisdom part and we want to associate ourselves with that. And sometimes it becomes fashionable to say that I'm an atheist because
we
I believe in.
We may want to associate with jnana, but jnana may not want to associate
absolutely
with us.
Swami says it cannot come like that. In fact, a very beautiful example of that is what Swami Vivekananda would say.
Hmm.
Because when Swami Vivekananda comes to Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, you know, we all know the story. He comes with the idea that, has anybody seen God?
Hmm.
You know, why is he asking that question? Because he's actually in the brink of atheism. He says, what is this idea of God? You're worshipping God and God has compassion and all. Is there anybody who has seen God? You know, when he comes to Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, he says that I've seen God. I speak to Mother all the time. And you know, one thing which Vivekananda writes in his works very beautifully, he says, you know, here is Ramakrishna Paramahamsa. He comes across as a devotee because all the time he's talking like a madman and crying for his mother. But because of that devotion, what is in his deep core is actually wisdom, right? And he says, compared to that, juxtaposed to that, here I am, in the outside, I'm actually all wisdom, because I'm always talking about, you know, Advaita and the oneness of the Atma and the Paramatma, whatever it is. But inside, I'm hollow because I don't have the devotion which actually has given me that basis for this wisdom. And he says, that is why he is the guru and I am the disciple. And I am ever trying to match up to what he is. And I think that is what is lacking most of the time in the argument.
You know, when you were narrating this about Vivekananda and Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, what happens later we know. When he asks, have you seen God? He says, yes, I see God as I see you. And the next moment Ramakrishna Paramahamsa touches Vivekananda. And, you know, Vivekananda has an experience which is inexplicable, and that is what actually makes him Vivekananda from Naren. You know, that is the beginning of his journey towards becoming Swami Vivekananda from just Naren. So when, you know, when I thought about it, what inspiration came was like what you said. Ultimately it was not the terrific words of Ramakrishna Paramahamsa or any of his intellectual intensities that charmed or pulled over Naren. It was the depth of his experience. And somehow, you know, when the depth of experience exists, it percolates through our words, our actions, our thoughts, everything. And that is a strong pointer for me that we should start working on that. You know, we should start working on our own faith. If I say that my faith is shaking or I get disturbed when somebody is saying this, it just means that it's not faith at all.
Right.
Because it's like, you know, if somebody, 100 people tell that sugar is not sweet, I may at best, I will not break my head, I will not get hurt, I will not get upset, I will not get emotional about it because I feel they don't know. If I'm truly convinced that sugar is sweet, nothing should actually shake me in that. But, you know, but if it is not sure, I will start shaking. So, you know, going from what happened between Ramakrishna Paramahamsa and Vivekananda, I really feel the core thing is to develop that intensity. From my own personal experience, I can say this, that many times, you know, Prem, when people ask me, why do you believe in Swami? And it's not like they come in a very critical mood. Sometimes they come in a very questioning mood. It is not actually to hurt me, but they can be quite brutal in their questioning. I have tried. Recently, I had an experience like that where one of my classmates who studied here, he's definitely into Swami. He's got married to a girl who is absolutely new to all the Swami stuff, and her only introduction to Swami has been during the Mahasamadhi time when all the negative things came up. So she's totally, you know, she can't. She says, you do it. Fine. I love you. So for your sake, I'll tolerate this, but don't tell me to do all this. So after years, he manages to get her to Parthi. And I thought that, you know, I will try. I started by talking on the fundamentals of faith and this. And it went on and on, you know, in the studio itself for 1.5 hours. For 1.5 hours it went on. And at the end of it, I don't know where, it was like a possibly a thing where she has decided something and I have decided something. But then they came home for lunch. And while having lunch, you know, somehow it just happened that began to narrate a few incidents. Few experiences with Swami. Unknown to me, this is Swami's work, you know. Unknown to me, an incident that I narrated had so much relevance for her personally in life. Because of which, in front of me, I saw a few tears coming from her eyes. And so moved she was. And that is when I realized, why was I trying to argue about Swami? Why couldn't I just share the rich, beautiful experiences that are there? And I feel that is one beautiful thing, because, you know, when I'm trying to argue intellectually, it might not be fully convinced or strong within me, but an experience that we have had is something inexplicable. And when we share it with our passion and our genuineness, that genuineness and honesty goes and makes some impact there. In fact, as I said, among the different responses, Brother Nakul on Facebook, he was sharing the same thing. He said that, anytime when people come and criticize, I just share with them one or two experiences. And I say, you see, you shared your criticism of Swami. I'll share with you my love for Swami. And we leave at that. And tell that, yes, I received what you said. Now, I have told you what I have told. That's it. And he says that he has noticed many people, somehow, you know, something gets triggered within them. And they are not the same most of the time when he meets them the next time. Because all said and done, that impact of personal experience is so tremendous. In fact, that is what actually happened to Naren also. It was the impact of the personal experience of Ramakrishna Paramahamsa which actually transformed into his own experience as well.
I mean, absolutely. You know, the experience part actually works both ways for yourself and for the others, because I've seen this many times. You know, when you start reading too much of Vedanta, you will get this, you know, oh, everybody is God and God is everything and divinity is all pervading and all that. But sometimes you need to stop yourself and say, but I've seen God as a person, right? Mm. At the end of the day, you have to have Swami's picture in front of you and say that, but I have lived with God embodied. So God can come in a human form. So God does have all these emotions which you worship Him with, right? You know, He is all compassionate, all love, because that is your experience. All said and done, you know, that experience has to eventually lead you to understanding God as your own, you know, inner nature. That's not something which any of us can deny. But it does not take away the fact that God can come in a human form. God can be that worship-worthy individual which, you know, becomes the center of all worship and devotion and religion and all of that. So you need to go back to that. And the other point is, you know, when you were sharing what Brother Nakul said, that you share your experience. See, the problem most of the time when we get into an argument, as I've said, that when someone comes and defends faith as well as defends non-belief, what we are trying to do in an argument is, we want the other person's validation to believe in what we already believe in. You know, when I'm talking about my faith in Swami, I feel that if I convince you, then I will become stronger in my conviction. And I think that's where most of the problem starts. Because
and if I'm not able to convince you, right, then I'm
failed. If you're able to convince, then well and good. You could probably feel happy about it and you'll feel stronger in your faith. But if you find a person who's going to be a match to you, or no more than a match to you, then you're finished, right? Because you start questioning your conviction, because you've gone out with the idea that if I convince you, then I will be stronger in my faith.
So the idea should not be to convince, but when we share our experience, the idea should be just so that we relive our experience,
right,
to strengthen. And when we are reliving it to strengthen ourselves, it has its own impact on the person who is listening. And if it doesn't have, it doesn't matter, we are feeling strengthened.
Exactly, because at the end of the day, I mean, it is not the argument which is going to clinch it. Because what you started off by saying about faith itself being beyond argument, faith itself being, so when that is the case, I mean, that is the truth. And the dangerous side of saying that relive experiences is, you know, I have seen this with a lot of devotees who have not had the opportunity to come too close to Swami, who have not witnessed things like Vibhuti coming in their house and all of that. They say, we don't have an experience to go with. So many times it's not even an experience which supports your faith, because faith is actually beyond all experience and beyond all reason.
No, totally agree to that. Even now when somebody asks me, you know, why do you believe Swami is God? I narrate to them 2-3 experiences. But you know, Prem, those are not the experience because of which I believe Swami is God. I was already believing that He is God before He saved my father from a heart attack or before He did something to me. It was not that those were the basis of my faith. I already believed that He is in God. So it's inexplicable. Faith just happens and then the experiences follow.
Exactly. And that is why when someone comes and puts an argument, even the argument that we give to counter it is actually not related to the faith at all. We can only counter the argument with an argument. An argument can never uphold faith in that sense. Even the idea that, you know, if you keep this idea in your mind, you will not give too much importance to your own argument, whether it falls flat or whether it, you know, turns out victorious. And that is something we need to keep in our mind, because at the end of the day when you go back to sleep, it's not based on whether you able to convince the other person or not. You being able to go back to your faith and saying that, you know, I believe in it. I actually don't know why I believe in it, but there's something deep within which makes me believe in it.
And being peaceful. Yeah, I think that can be a very nice way to see at the end of the day. If I am peaceful, that's enough. All this is ways so that we get peaceful. At this point in time, I think, dear listeners, we'll take another quick break, and in the next segment of our satsang, we will go into 2-3 things that Bhagwan has said, and I'm sure that will be a very enlightening experience.
साई की ओर आओ चले सत्य साई की ओर जीवन को निर्मल करे आओ चले सत्य धर्म की ओर जीवन को पावन करे आओ चले हम सब साई हमारे जीवन सहारे साई हमारे जीवन सहारे जीवन को उज्जवल बनाने वाले तन मन में साई समाए उस साई रे चले सत्य धर्म की ओर और चले हम सब जीवन में कुछ भी पाना है तो शांति का सुख लाना है तो जीवन में कुछ भी पाना है तो शांति का सुख लाना है तो के बंधन जात और पात के काम क्रोध के लोभ मोह के और चले सत्य धर्म की ओर और चले हम सब मानव सेवा ही माधव सेवा है ये दिव्य रीति तुमने सिखाई सही लाई प्यासे दिलों की प्यास बुझाई ओ साई रे आओ चले शांति प्रेम की ओ जीवन को पावन करे ज्ञानी चाव को साई देवा को साई देवा
ओ साई देवा
को साई देवा
ओ साई देवा को साई देवा
निपरी आई रे डलो लोकानी माचाव
Sai Deva, O Sai Deva, O Sai Deva, O Sai Deva,
Sai Mana Pranamu, Sai Mana Ganyamu, Sai Mana Jeevita Dharamu,
O Sai Deva, O Sai Deva, O Sai Deva, O Sai Deva. 75 long years you have taught us that service to man is service to God. O Sai Deva, O Sai Deva, O Sai Deva, O Sai Deva, Sai Mana Pranamu, Sai Mana Gamyamu, Sai Mana Jeevita.
धर्म के
धर्म
जीवन को पावन
करे
Welcome back, dear listeners. We are in the middle of an interesting discussion and an important one for all of us, because as devotees, we are expected to get more and more attached and emotionally love Swami, because that is one way which your heart gets purified. And we've spoken about this many times. This is one attachment which has the ability to let you free of all the other attachments. So in that sense, you're supposed to get attached emotionally in the beginning to Swami, but in the process what happens is, to an extent you become vulnerable when people speak ill about Swami or people question your allegiance to Swami. And the question is, how do you deal with that? And that's the thing we're talking about. One thing which we said was, avoid bad company to start with. Don't think that you're too smart, that you have the ability to defend Swami. You know, many times it comes down to that. Because when you start getting into an argument, it's not about Swami versus non-Swami. You know, that is a different concept altogether. It's about my ability to defend Swami and your ability to defile Swami. It becomes like that. So in that sense, the person standing in front of me, if he is better intellectually and he's better at argument, I will of course lose. And that does not mean that Swami is anyway smaller. It means that I am a poor arguer, right? It always comes down to the abilities, not really the truth. So in that sense, as much as possible, avoid bad company, because Swami would often say this, you know, when somebody comes up to you and say, oh, I don't believe in the existence of God, Swami would say, fine, tell them it's okay. I mean, that is your belief, but I believe. And you have no question, I mean, you have no authority to question my belief or question my God. You don't have a God, you know, suit yourself, but you don't come and ask me about it. And in a sense, Swami, that is a way of literally offending the person away from you, saying that, no, this is my thing. I am not going to let you trample upon it. I'm not even going to invite you into an argument and let you trample upon it. Right?
I see, that's very, very nice, I feel, because it's not that I'm getting into an argument, but at the same time, I'm ensuring that I'm firm. I'm firm and polite. In fact, you know, Sister Pratibha from Mangalore, she writes very interestingly. She says, it's quite complex. I don't think I'll be able to practice it, but it's very interesting. Her solution was, she says, what will I do if somebody comes and criticizes Swami in Arabic? I don't even understand Arabic, right? So it doesn't matter at all. You can go on as long as you like. It doesn't matter to me at all. She says that when somebody starts criticizing Swami, possibly she speaks from her own experience, because she might have had such things. She says that I just switch off that part of my brain which gives meaning to the words. So she says, if they're speaking in my language also, it's like, it's no, I don't understand it at all. So I don't know, practically I feel it's very tough for me, but this is a very interesting thing. So she says, I just switch off. So in that sense, whatever they are giving to me, it doesn't come to me at all. So as I said, it looks like a difficult thing to practice, but this is what I think Swami refers to when in his discourse, you know, he narrates the story of Gautam Buddha. When a person comes and starts abusing Gautam Buddha, and somebody who loves Gautam Buddha says, how is it that you are not retaliating? And Gautam Buddha asks, you know, Swami narrated this in his discourse. Gautam Buddha says that, you know, when I come begging for alms, what do you do? says, Master, I give you alms. I give you, it's an honor, it's a privilege, it's great pleasure for me to give you alms. He says, but if I don't receive those alms, what will happen? He says, it's my misfortune. No, what happens then? Yeah, I take back the alms. He says, the same happens with words also. When people come and shower their words on me, it's only if I accept them that they become mine. If I don't accept, they go back to the person who has given. So I think this is what possibly Sister Pratibha was referring to, that the hurt we feel, the pain that we feel, it's only when we accept it, when we give importance. And you know, I could so much relate to this one particular aspect, because over the last few years, I've been regularly posting different stuff on Facebook and there are a lot of comments. And when certain themes are taken up, I see that there are both negative and positive comments. And invariably, Prem, I notice that I go and make it a point to respond to each and every negative comment.
Mm-hmm.
While I might not respond to every positive comment. This is what I observed a few years back. And then I felt, why is it that I'm focusing on the 5 or 6% negative comments that come? Mm-hmm. There are so many positives that come. And when I focus on that, that post in Facebook actually makes me feel sad because of those 3 negative comments. You know, that is when I decided that possibly I'll focus on responding to each and every positive comment. Why should I give importance to something that I don't want? So, you know, it really helped me a lot personally. And I feel when Bhagwan narrates this, in fact, not only this Buddha story, Swami tells it in another way also. He says, if somebody criticizes you silently, it remains within them. If somebody criticizes you loudly, it goes into the air. Why should you be bothered? Mm-hmm. Meaning, it affects you only when you decide to receive it. If you choose not to receive it, nothing can affect you.
You know, going in that same direction, there's another thing which probably as people who are trying to defend our belief will have to do. And there is a incident which they speak, I think it is from the life of Mahatma Gandhi.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether you're doing the right thing or the wrong thing, you will always get flack, right? In fact, if you're doing the right thing, you will get more flack. You will get more people who are very critical of you, because, as I said, people who defend, they're defending their foolishness. They don't want to, you know, appear like they are the wrong ones. So they defend their wrong by saying that, you know, what you're doing is wrong.
Hmm.
Because otherwise the question will come, why aren't you doing it? If you agree
Correct.
With it, why aren't you doing what you're praising the other person of doing? So apparently, you know, Mahatma Gandhi would get a lot of letters, stinkers as we call them.
Mm.
Plenty of them actually, you know, criticizing his ways, criticizing his choices. Apart from the many letters which would come in praise of his work. So his secretary once noticed that some letters when Mahatma Gandhi reads, you know, after he reads them, the olden days it used to be in many, many papers, you know, many sheets of papers. So he would remove the paper clip and he would put the paper in the dustbin. Okay.
Hmm.
And some papers he would fold and he'll keep them. So when asked, Mahatma Gandhi said, you know, in this letter, the only useful thing is the paper clip. So I've kept it aside. Right? The rest of it is junk. So it is consigned to the waste
dustbin.
Paper, dustbin. You know, that's a very wise thing to do. But, you know, when you're talking about an argument, something which I once was speaking to a devotee, it's not a non-devotee, I was speaking to a devotee which she brought up a point which was very important. You know, she said, you know, you boys, Swami's students and Swami's devotees, all the time you keep talking about Swami's work. You say, oh, Swami built a hospital, or Swami gave free education. And this lady, she was an elderly lady from Russia. And she said, do you know that even Lenin and Stalin gave free education and free medicine?
Mm.
In Russia, everybody had free education, everybody had free medicine in the communist regime of Lenin and Stalin. So what is so great about it? You know, what she was saying was a very important thing. Though she was countering an argument probably which I was giving, it was actually showing a hole in my argument. It is because I am giving the place that I am giving Swami, and I am attaching it to this idea that Swami gave free education and free water and all of that, which is actually absolutely absurd. Swami is God for reasons much beyond all of this.
You know, one thing that I commonly say is calling Swami a social reformer is akin to calling Jesus a shepherd.
Right.
Of course, he was that, but he is much more than that.
Exactly. So when somebody is, you know, giving you an argument like this, they might also be pointing out at a flaw in your argument or a flaw in your approach to Swami. So if we are wise enough, we'll keep the paperclip aside or we'll dump the whole thing into the dustbin.
In fact, that is precisely what Swami spoke in his discourse on the 24th of May 1992.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than talk about it, I think I will read out that relevant portion. It applies to criticism in general, but I think we can definitely take it to criticism on Swami as well. Swami says, let us say somebody has criticized you. You are angry. When you get angry, do you react immediately? Think to yourself, do I have in me the defects that have been pointed out by them? If in case those defects are there in me, then is it not my mistake? Why should I get angry? Let me correct myself. However, if the blemishes pointed out by them are not present in me, then why should I get angry with them? Because they are telling lies. If you thus give an opportunity for such an inquiry and spend time in introspection, your anger and irritation will subside. He says, students, the correct ideal for you is me, myself. My life is my message. So many people criticize me. Many others glorify me. But I do not bloat with praise, nor get depressed with censure. Because if things are there in me are spoken in front of me, I need not worry. If things that are not in me are told at any other place, I still need not worry. Why they keep talking about blemishes that are not in me, then if they keep talking about blemishes that are not in me, then what is the necessity for me to worry? Here is an example, Swami says. When people call me Buttatala Sai Baba, meaning Sai Baba with a basket-like head, I need not get offended because I have a basket-like head. Look at Swami, how sweetly he's saying that. Therefore, I must accept this as true. But if they call me Pattatala Sai Baba, meaning Sai Baba with a bald head, then it is not true. So why should I accept it? Therefore, if blemishes that are not there in me are mentioned right in front of me, even then I will not accept it. That is the right kind of determination. You must have self-confidence in yourself. Without self-confidence, at the slightest provocation, you will get either elated or depressed. It will become like bumps in an aeroplane. Therefore, students, develop self-confidence first, he says, you know. I feel this is so practical, you know. When it comes down, see, this is about criticism in general. When it comes to criticism in Swami, that's why it becomes so important that our confidence and faith is there. You know, we know for sure that it can never be the first case where Swami says that what they're speaking is true and we are not accepting it. Because if they are criticizing Swami in the negative ways, we know that it is not true. So it is not at all the first case. It's only the second case where they are speaking things that are not true. Then Swami says, then why do you get affected? If you are getting affected, it only means you are lacking self-confidence or you are lacking faith. So I feel it's a very strong pointer for us. You know, if we have to be equanimous and be able to take the pin the way Mahatma Gandhiji did, I think we have to be absolutely fixed in our faith. And fixed meaning not, I'm not meaning narrow-minded, I'm meaning that we are entrenched in our faith and in our self-confidence.
And probably we'll end with something which Swami once told in a discourse, which in a way will lead to the rest of the discussion, but not now, next week. In a discourse when Swami was speaking, Swami said, you know, some people come to Puttaparthi, and in the train or in their office, they will ask, so where are you going? They will tell, we're going to a place near Bangalore. You know, we are going to meet relatives. And Swami said, why are you ashamed to say that you are coming to Puttaparthi? Why are you ashamed to say that you are coming for darshan? Right? And that is probably the other end of you going into a shell or you becoming silent or you avoiding bad company, where you do not have the confidence to defend Swami, so you might as well say that you completely hide the fact that you are a devotee of Swami. And Swami said, what stupidity and what cowardice is that? And I think that's the other end, because that comes from another form of ego. Swami would often say that, you know, if lack of confidence is also a form of ego. We all associate with pride and overconfidence with ego, but, you know, even that feeling of I'm smaller than the others or I'm having something which I need to hide, that is also a form of ego. So you coming out of an argument should not be with a feeling that, oh, I'm embarrassed to call myself a Sai devotee. I'm embarrassed to call myself as someone who's coming from Puttaparthi. But it should come from the fact that, you know, I have nothing to hide. I have nothing to feel bad about. But for the Loka Kalyanam, as they say, for the peace of the environment, I'm actually just stepping aside.
Absolutely. No, I think this association of ego with pride comes because of wrong understanding of the word. When, you know, it happens also, you know, whenever even I speak, I almost use the words ego and pride interchangeably. But every time when we focus on what Swami says ego is identifying with the body, body identification or dehabhimanam, we understand that whether we identify with our body in a positive way and have pride, or whether we identify it in a negative way and have embarrassment and self-criticism, both are ego, because we are identifying with the body. It's only when we associate with Swami within, the Atma Abhimanam, the Atma within, that we are not being egoistic. I think every time we remind ourselves of this definition of ego that Swami has given, we will be able to understand those few moments when we are not being egoistic or when we are being egoistic. Dear listeners, the time in our studios is already 1:55 and about to turn 1:56. So there is one other beautiful concept, the concept that Swami often calls as be, do and then tell. Both Prem and me, we feel that this concept is another beautiful way of facing criticism about Swami, and also a wonderful way in which we should lead our lives as Sai devotees. This is so beautiful a concept that we thought we will keep it for our next satsang. In the meanwhile, do write in with your thoughts, your feedback, your feelings, your experiences to listener@radiosai.org, or you can message on our Facebook page or on my personal Facebook page. You can send in as a message. As I said, we will try our best to share as many of these experiences, insights and feedback as possible, because this is truly a global satsang for which we are very grateful to Swami. We end this segment by offering it at Bhagwan's lotus feet and by playing out this song for you, on the other side of which you will be greeted by Brother Chandu. So enjoy the song, and dear listeners, we will meet you again next week on the same theme, focusing little more on the be, do, tell aspect which Swami has beautifully given us.
सफर में दिल चलने लगा है फूलों की इन बगियों में मन टहलने चला है कुछ तो है इन ख्वाबों में दिल से निकलते नहीं कुछ तो है इन राहों में मिलती यहां हर खुशी अब इन लम्हों के बारिश में भीगने चला हूँ मैं यादों के सफर में दिल चलने लगा है फूलों की बगियों में मन टहलने चला है लगती है जैसे बातें आज की ये बातें लगती है जैसे यादें आज की अब इन लम्हों के बारिश में भीगने चला हूँ मैं यादों के सफर में दिल चलने लगा है Mm-hmm.
बगियों में मन टहलने चला है।